Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Chancellor Freddie Pitcher, and I'd like to welcome all of you here to this courtroom setting. This is the United States Court of Appeals for Armed Forces. This is a very important court, a court that many of you may not have heard about, but it is very involved in handling a lot of major cases involving armed forces. We are very privileged today to have this court to come to Southern and sit and have oral arguments. Also, our students, we have two students who will be participating making oral arguments today themselves. This is a great educational opportunity for our law center. After the court hear the arguments today, they will be at Loyola on tomorrow and at Mississippi College on Wednesday. So you are in a very unique position to hear this court. It's basically a five-judge court. Three of the judges will be participating via telephonically, I understand.
Well, two will.
Two of the judges will be participating telephonically. Three of the judges are here. So I ask that you turn your cell phones off and sit back and join me in being educated as to the work of this court.
Thank you, Chancellor. My name is Bill DeSico. I'm the clerk of the court, and I just wanted to make a few announcements before we get started. First of all, this case that you're about to hear is an actual case. This case was tried by court-martial in San Diego, California in 2003, and has been winding its way through the military appellate system until it's come to this court. In the court brochures that are outside, the smaller brochure, on the back cover, it has a schematic design of the process on where this court fits in the court system, and you can take a look at that at your leisure. Also on the back cover, it has our court's website address, so if you want to read more about the court, read all of our opinions, they're all online. Today's oral argument, United States versus Flores. The order of oral argument will be appellant will be first, and that will be counsel representing Flores. That is Lieutenant M. Over here, he will argue first. Following Lieutenant M, we will have Jamesti Pullins-Gorm, who will be arguing as amicus, supporting the appellant. She will have 10 minutes. Lieutenant M is allotted 30, and Major Brian Keller will argue for the United States. He will have 30 minutes. Lieutenant Kim will reserve 5 minutes of his time for rebuttal. So Lieutenant M, Lieutenant Yen, our student, the government, and then final rebuttal. Following the argument, the judges will remain in place for a question and answer session. If you have any questions about the military justice system in general, they'd be happy to answer them. They will not be able, however, to answer questions about the case they just heard or about other cases that could be heard by the court that are in the system. Photography today is permitted, but we would ask that you restrict it to the very beginning and the very end of the arguments. And during the question and answer session, you take all pictures you want to take. Okay? Just that we're trying to keep the number of photographs down during the argument because it's a little distracting. And with that, I think we can get started. Are there any questions? And you all got your cell phones and pagers turned on. Okay, great. All rise. The Chief Judge and the Associate Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. Today, the Moot Courtroom at at the Southern University Law Center has been transformed into a federal courthouse. We're honored to be here, and we're most appreciative of the gracious hospitality of the Law Center in hosting this oral argument. Judges Baker and Ryan unavoidably have been delayed due to transportation problems, but they will be participating in this case on the record. We'll now proceed with the case that we'll be hearing this afternoon, United States against Flores. Counsel for the defense, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please do so.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Anthony Yim, and I represent the appellant, Private First Class Rodolfo Flores, United States Marine Corps. With this court's permission, I'd like to respectfully request 5 minutes of time for rebuttal.
That's granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Fourth Amendment applies equally across this country, even at Marine Corps boot camp. When the commanding officer of the 1st Recruit Training Battalion ordered a warrantless search of Platoon 1101's luggage, he violated appellant's Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable searches and seizures. The military judge properly found that the search was illegal and found no exigent circumstances to justify such a warrantless search.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that the law of the case? Are we as a court? All these briefs assume this search was invalid from the get-go.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that it? Do we have to take that under the law of the case doctrine? Is that the law of the case?
Your Honor, in fact, appellant goes so far as to suggest that this court doesn't have jurisdiction to hear whether the underlying search was legal or illegal. This court's jurisdiction is certiorari based, and thus this court obviously can specify the issue for certiorari. However, the government did not cross appeal that, and thus appellant argues that it's waived.
Counsel, where in your brief did you argue that we didn't have jurisdiction to consider the underlying search?
Your Honor, that's in the reply brief under Section C.
No jurisdiction or law of the case?
We argue both, Your Honor. We argue that if this court does not feel that this court does not have jurisdiction, that it will then revert to law of the case.
And what is the lawful basis that you would cite for holding that a law of the case ruling, that is, that we are bound by a decision of a lower court, is a matter of jurisdiction?
Your Honor, I can refer to my brief really quickly.
Yes, please.
I believe appellant this was a unique issue. That apparently merely cites that Article 67 itself, 10 U.S.C. 867, limits this court to only answering questions of law that this court specifically certifies for review. So therefore, this court does have the ability to hear the issue of the legality of the underlying search. However, this court would have to specify that issue back to both appellant and to the government. As of right now, this court only has jurisdiction to hear two questions of law. One is if appellant has standing to challenge the illegal search, and the second is whether the inevitable discovery doctrine applies.
Do you have any case law underlying that assertion?
No, Your Honor. There is no case law either for or against appellant.
Okay, that's an original, a novel issue under Article 67?
Yes, Your Honor. It seems to be a novel issue.
No case law for or against? Isn't there substantial case law stating that the law of the case doctrine, that is, the doctrine that we would be bound by a decision of the lower court so long as the government didn't appeal it or a party didn't appeal it, is not a rule of jurisdiction, but is a matter of discretion. Don't we have longstanding case law that states that?
Yes, Your Honor, that might be true. However, I believe that was specified for appellant. However, for the government, because they have the unique certification ability to grant themselves certification, we felt that, as listed in the reply brief, we felt that was an additional factor that should be considered by this court. But moving on to the first granted issue, we see that the case law is settled that if appellant discards his luggage in response to an illegal police conduct, he retains standing to challenge that search. The key question before this court is when appellant switched the bag. The military judge made an erroneous finding of fact when he found that appellant switched bags long before learning of the upcoming search. There is no fact in the record that supports the military judge's finding of fact. Sergeant Miramontes testifies that Private Sequeira believed that his bags were switched right before the search. This is reflected on the record on page 71-72.
Could you summarize briefly the chronology that you're relying on for your proposition here?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe both appellant and the government are in agreement that at approximately 07:30, the Marines are marched to the parade deck, told to drop off their luggage, and they're subsequently then gone to proceed to the graduation ceremony. Approximately at around 0900, the commanding officer issues the order to secure the luggage. Sometime after that, the graduation ceremony happens. The platoon comes back, and this is there's no time dates, so all we can rely on is the evidence in the record. Sometime after this, the platoon then comes back to the parade deck, is told they're about to be searched, is then mustered, they grab their luggage, they're lined up in formation, and then are marched into the squad bay in order for the search to occur.
Consul, what is the important event here? Is the important event when the battalion commander decided that he was going to search the luggage, or is the important event when Flores learned there was going to be a search?
The important event is when Flores actually abandoned the bag, Your Honor.
Okay. And the military judge, I believe, held that he abandoned his bag after he learned of the investigation and before the baggage was seized, but they did not, but he did not address when Flores learned of the search. And if I understand the law correctly, if Flores abandoned his bag after he learned of the search that the military judge found was illegal, then he did not voluntarily abandon it, and he maintains the ability to, the standing to challenge it.
Yes,
so isn't the time he learned of the search, is that important, and is that in the record anywhere?
Your Honor, I seem to recall they never, actually, I know this for a fact, they never specify exactly when the Marines learned upon the upcoming search.
Okay.
I'll have to get this on the reply, but I seem to recall there is an implication that the Marines learned that after they were marched back from the graduation ceremony, which would make sense because the normal course of military duties would be that they were to grab their luggage and then depart for the day.
When the battalion commander made his decision that there was going to be a search, do we know whether or not the platoon was already out on the drill pad? Were they at graduation at that time, or were they?
Yes, Your Honor. It seems to be that they were at the graduation proceedings at that time. It seems to be that they were ordered, and from general inferences of how these graduation ceremonies normally go, once they had their luggage on the parade deck, they were in military duties of arranging for graduation ceremony and so forth. So they were still under the control of the United States government, Your Honor. Again, this is the only evidence in the record that gives us an actual timeline as to when appellant abandoned his bag.
Is it the defense view in this case, and I believe you stated at one point, that is that the defendant in this case did abandon the bag?
Yes, Your Honor.
This is not a case in which the defense is arguing that someone else mistakenly picked it up.
Your Honor, appellant, that's correct, Your Honor.
He abandoned his bag.
That's correct, Your
Honor. So when a person abandons property, under what circumstance do they nonetheless retain a right of privacy in property that they've abandoned?
Yes, Your Honor. They still maintain the standing if the abandonment was done in reaction to illegal police conduct. This court has held in Robinson, and in fact, this very federal circuit, the Fifth Circuit, which is consistent with this, the Fifth Circuit's case in Fletcher versus Wainwright, federal courts, including our court, has held that if an appellant discards his items in direct response to illegal police conduct, he maintains standing to challenge the search. In fact, if I may respectfully invite this court's attention to Robinson on page 110. This court stated, quote, "The crucial question is whether a nexus exists between improper police conduct and a discard of articles by appellant. Therefore, if the appellant learned that he was about to be searched and thus abandons his bag in a last-minute attempt to avoid detection, he maintains standing pursuant to Robinson, pursuant to Mitchell, and pursuant to other federal cases that he is allowed to challenge that search, Your Honor."
Who has the burden? We're on appeal now, and we have property that was abandoned. Typically, the government would prevail that point on the issue of standing because the property is abandoned. But now there's a question that has arisen as to whether the abandonment was done in response to arguably illegal police conduct. Does the government have to then affirmatively show in every case of abandonment that it wasn't done in response to the police conduct? Or does the defense have to make some initial showing that there was at least arguably illegal police conduct before any kind of a showing has to be made?
Well, obviously the appellant would have to make the initial burden of proof, since the appellant would be the moving party to suppress the evidence. And in fact, I believe appellant has made such a showing. Again, this issue comes down to a finding of fact. In order to overturn a finding of fact on appeal, appellant must demonstrate that the fact was either clearly erroneous or unsupported by the record. Appellant believes he has met this burden. The military judge's timeline is not supported by the record.
Well, what would support the defense timeline? In other words, if the defense has to show that there was knowledge of illegal conduct at the time the property was abandoned, what in this record demonstrates that?
Your Honor, appellant respectfully disagrees with the premise of the question. Appellant does not have to know that the search is going to be illegal when he abandons the bag. He just has to know that there's going to be a search.
What in the record shows that he knew that there was going to be a search?
Again, the only evidence in the record is on record on page 71 and 72, where Private Sequeira believes that his bags were switched immediately before the search.
Sequeira believes it. But whose knowledge is critical in this case? What difference does it make what Sequeira believes? Did Sequeira say that he talked to your client in this case?
No, Your Honor, he didn't.
Well, how would he have any knowledge then? What relevance at all is his hearsay belief here in this case?
Your Honor, it would go to a pattern of evidence. We see that when they opened up appellant's bag, we see that he could quite have easily abandoned this under the trial judge's finding of fact. He could have quite have easily abandoned the incriminating evidence under the cover of night if he had decided to abandon the evidence such as the military judge suggested.
Well, what he could have done, he could have done many different things. We could sit here all afternoon with a wide variety of hypotheticals. My question is, what did the other Marine know about the intent or knowledge of your client?
Yes, Your Honor. He did not know anything explicitly. However, again, appellant argues through implication. Appellant essentially abandoned his entire bag.
We have to find abuse of discretion here. Is that enough to posit an abuse of discretion on?
It is, Your Honor, because the finding of fact itself is not supported by the record. We see that appellant literally...
It appears nothing is supported by the record.
Your Honor...
You've got a supposition on one side and a supposition on the other.
Except for appellant's side, we actually have at least one statement that corroborates... We have many statements, excuse me, that corroborates appellant's timeline. If appellant was caught with his entire bag, we had his uniforms, his alpha uniforms in it, letters, pictures. Essentially, in essence, we have an entire orgy of evidence pointing to appellant.
Counsel, what is your burden here? I mean, do you have to establish your alternative timeline, the appellant's timeline, or do you just have to show that the record does not support the findings that were made by the military judge?
Appellant has some hurdles to make, but appellant believes that he has made all the hurdles. The first hurdle is appellant has to show that the record, as the finding of fact, is clearly erroneous. Once that is done, we now, assuming that appellant abandoned the bag immediately before the search, we must then move on to the issue of whether the search was illegal. However, the military judge and the lower court both agreed that the search was illegal. Therefore, appellant feels that burden is fairly de minimis.
So really, the only thing you're arguing before us today on this issue is that the record does not support the findings made by the military judge, and you don't feel you need to establish an alternative timeline, or this could have happened when, or this might have happened here. The fact, from your perspective, is that the record doesn't support what the military judge found.
Well, Your Honor, it's kind of an either-or, according to the timeline. I believe that only two possibilities have been suggested. Again, reflecting upon this court's language in Robinson, this court said if there's a nexus between the abandonment and the improper police conduct. If appellant, again, abandons his articles in reaction to a search. Appellant believes that that is the nexus that is needed to demonstrate in order to have appellant to have standing. Once appellant obviously has standing to challenge an illegal search, we must then move to the secondary analysis of whether the search was legal or not.
Counsel, under the military rules of evidence and the rules for courts martial, can a defendant testify on a pretrial motion with assurance that that testimony won't be used against him later in trial?
Yes, Your Honor, he can.
Okay. And who would be the person who'd have the best knowledge as to what the intent was of the defendant in this case, that is, whether he abandoned it because he wanted to get rid of it and was worried that he was going to get caught, or he abandoned it because there was an imminent search? Who would be the person who'd have the best knowledge of that?
I believe the appellant would, Your Honor.
Okay. Did the appellant testify in this case?
Did not, Your Honor.
Would it be permissible for the military judge at the trial level or our court at this level in reviewing the decision of the military judge to take into account the fact that he did not testify? We can't take that into account on the issue of guilt or innocence because he's got a privilege of testifying against testifying guilt or innocence. But since he has no privilege in the pretrial setting, why can't we take into account that the person who had the best knowledge of intent here didn't testify?
Your Honor, throughout the Constitution and throughout federal jurisprudence, there is a presumption of innocence until found guilty. Appellant doesn't need to come forward to just clear his name. He should be found presumed innocent. Therefore, while appellant's lack of testimony at a pretrial hearing may be, you know, noteworthy, so to say, for this court to infer that just because the appellant didn't testify at a pretrial motion, he therefore is guilty, seems to be anathema to the general federal jurisprudence.
If the military judge had taken into account and he said, I have no idea whether he's guilty or innocent, and I'm making no inference as to whether he's guilty or innocent, I'm making an inference that if he knew that if he's the one who abandoned the property based upon the imminent search, he'd come forward and tell us about it. He has nothing to lose by coming forward and telling us about it in a pretrial motion.
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, actually, appellate defense counsel did wonder if I should attach an affidavit to the record from the appellant stating that, you know, what his present state of mind was at the time. However, again, the analysis...
Would we even be able to conclude that, to take that into account at this stage? Wouldn't that be an improper supplementation of the record?
Exactly, Your Honor. And in fact, as Your Honor clearly highlights, the analysis is what the military judge knew at the time he knew it.
And he knew that your client didn't testify.
Yes, Your Honor. However, there's no indication that he considers that either for or against the record.
Okay,
however,
you.
Again, reflecting back to what we have, we seem to have only one. We seem to have multiple inferences that appellant abandons his search right before the abandons his luggage right before the search.
What did the appellant maintain? What was the defense's position at trial? Was it not that the appellant immediately before being called in there, impulsively switched the bags?
Your Honor, I can't remember at trial what trial defense counsel was.
There appears to have been some variance with what he maintained at trial and what he maintained later on.
Yes, Your Honor, but
okay.
There was variance on the government, too. I believe the government's closing argument in that pretrial motion argues the appellant's timeline, that appellant switched it right before. So there is a little bit of variance. But, Your Honor, again, we argue that there is a nexus that exists and that we have clearly met this nexus. If there are no further questions, appellant would like to move on to the second grant.
Please do.
Thank you. Your Honor, the government would not have inevitably discovered appellant's confession because independent evidence provided no usable leads. The inevitable discovery doctrine ignores what hypothetically could have happened had the police acted lawfully. Instead, the inevitable discovery doctrine refers to a discovery that is despite of and independent of the lawful behavior that would have focused the investigation onto appellant. In front of this court, we only have $1,500 in cash and three envelopes that were subsequently found in a vent in the same squad bay. Appellant argues that no new leads were generated by this evidence. The sergeant...
But isn't there evidence that the government would have been able to produce outside of his confession, outside of your client's confession? In other words, they knew that he was the scribe. They had the records as to who was assigned on the various fire watches. They knew when the withdrawals were being made. And all of that could have come into their position easily without this confession at all.
Your Honor, in fact, I'll do you one better. They not only came about that easily, they already had that information.
Okay.
So, Your Honor, at Friday morning, when the commanding officer is briefed of the situation and the commanding officer orders the illegal search, he already has this knowledge. He knows that appellant is the platoon scribe. He knows the modus operandi of the crime. Instead, we have no identification that would have focused the investigation onto appellant. We have no identification marks. We have no fingerprints.
As of when?
As on the 1500, the subsequent evidence, Your Honor.
Okay, as of the time it was discovered?
And to my
well, you had the PIN numbers stuck in there with the money.
Yes, Your Honor. But those weren't that wasn't in appellant's handwriting. My understanding is that those were in the individual's handwriting.
Well, but isn't it enough when they knew it was the scribe, they knew he'd collected them, and they knew unauthorized withdrawals were made, and here's a big wad of money with these PIN numbers. And there appears to have been some correlation between opened envelopes with PIN numbers and loss of money. Isn't that enough to direct their attention toward him?
No, Your Honor, it's not. Because they
Why not?
Because they knew that evidence. When they knew that evidence when they committed the illegal search. The $1,500 and the three envelopes didn't provide new information. In fact, at the time that Sergeant Maxson is briefing the commanding officer, they know that appellant collected those envelopes and that he's the platoon scribe. They also know that approximately 59 to 79 other Marines had access to the duty hut to where these envelopes were stored. They also know that there was no accountability for the fire watches. In fact, using Sergeant Maxson's own words, quote, "The fire watch really had no control over the platoon. People were in and out of the squad bay. Recruits were doing laundry, ironing, basically getting ready to graduate on Friday." Quote, "It was kind of just a mess." It was very clear that the same evidence that that $1,500 and three envelopes produced was the exact same evidence that they had already known about. They knew the modus operandi of the crime. They knew that somebody had broken into the envelopes that were stored in the squad bay. They knew that somebody had stolen the cards out of the Marines' uniforms when they were exercising, that these Marine uniforms were hanging on the beds.
How do we know they knew all this stuff? I mean, is there anything in the record that says it, or are you just surmising all this at that time?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the testimony between pages 39 to 50, and I will get specific page numbers on reply, indicate that they're aware of the fact that of how the crime was committed.
Counsel, is it necessary for your argument that you take the position that no new evidence was discovered 2 weeks later? That is, there was some new evidence, the amount of money that was secreted in the in that compartment. What argument would you make if there is, without conceding that there's no, if you assume that there is new evidence, do you have any other argument?
Yes, Your Honor. The fact that we in fact, appellant actually classifies it as new evidence. But the evidence has to focus the investigation onto appellant. We see that, again, no fingerprints, no identification marks, nothing that would have identified appellant over the other 79 other Marines. And in fact, the record seems to indicate that it wasn't even appellant's money at all. If we take a close look at the record, we see on reflected on page 44, we see that there are three co-conspirators originally named, appellant and two others. And yet, one of the co-conspirators, when interviewed and interrogated and investigated, mysteriously, the money never shows up. And then when they go back to appellant to ask him, were there three conspirators? He says, no. We didn't find any money on Private Stonball. He says, no, there's only two.
Counsel, finally next, what relief are you asking for in this case? Are you asking for the charges to be dismissed or for the charges to be set aside with the possibility of rehearing?
Your Honor, we ask for the charges to be set aside.
The government could retry this case, in your view, without the confession and use the other evidence.
They could if they wanted to, Your Honor, but again, they would be limited to three envelopes and $1,500.
Or any other evidence that they might developed through subsequent investigation. They don't have to retry the case as it stood at that time, do they?
Well, Your Honor, they have to be clear if they have to be clear that it's independent of the illegal search and the illegal taint.
So everything that you listed before in response to my question, they knew, according to your response, they knew before the search. They knew about all this other items as to that he had access to it, the fire watch, and all of that. So that is independent of the confession.
Yes, Your Honor. So the government,
they could use that.
The government is free to argue that three envelopes and $1,500 without appellant's fingerprints or identifying marks proves beyond a reasonable doubt that appellant committed these crimes. However, it's even doubtful that would even survive a motion.
They would be precluded from showing motive and opportunity from all the other evidence that would have been put in about his duties as a scribe and what went on during the evenings, the other evidence they had?
Yes, Your Honor. However, again,
they would not be precluded from putting that in, would they?
They would not. However, again, any competent defense lawyer would calmly point out that 79 other Marines had the exact same opportunity, exact same motive, and therefore it seems doubtful that the government could actually make their case. However, if the government wishes to try, far be it from a poor appellate defense counsel to prohibit the government from going after.
You only have an opportunity to continue on rebuttal.
Thank you. Appellant respectfully request the remainder of the time for rebuttal.
We have amicus curiae presenting argument today, and we'll now hear for counsel for the amicus.
Good afternoon, Justices of the Court. May it please the Court, my name is Jameski Pullins-Gorm, and I'm speaking on behalf of the appellant by way of amicus curiae, restricted to the issue on standing. Because you're already familiar with the facts of the case, and due to the essence of time, I will omit reiterating to you those facts and pass over directly into the issue. Your Honors, we are here today at the outset to decide the issue of whether the lower court erred in finding that Private Flores did not have standing to challenge the violation of his Fourth Amendment rights. We pray that this honorable court reverse the decision of the trial court because Private Flores did, in fact, have standing. And alternatively, Private Flores did not have the requisite intent required for abandonment. Now, the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution provides that or protects individuals from unreasonable searches and seizures. Additionally, it provides individuals who do have standing with the remedy to challenge the illegal search and the seizure in instances where their constitutional rights have been violated. Article 3, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution provides that in order for a person to have standing, they must meet three requirements. One, there must be an injury in fact. Private Flores was injured when his Fourth Amendment rights were violated. Two, there must be a causal nexus between the injury and the conduct complained of. It is because of the government's illegal search that Private Flores' Fourth Amendment rights were violated. And
counsel,
three, yes?
Would you comment on the law of the case question I asked earlier, counsel? Because we're all talking about this illegal search, and we're all basically premising it on the premise that it's illegal. Would you care to comment on the law of the case doctrine as it's applied here? Are we to take it as established that this search was unlawful?
Yes, we are to take it that as established that the search was unlawful based on the concept that the individuals, the government did not have any probable cause to warrant their search to any specific individual.
Well, there is a doctrine of inspection in military law that sometimes comes into play on searches and seizures. Would you like to comment on that?
There's a few cases that the government mentions in their brief, and those cases have allowed searches of particular military barracks, but those searches were of the barracks in general, not of those specific individuals.
Well, but wasn't everybody searched here?
Yes.
Wasn't the whole platoon searched? So it didn't focus on any individual. They had no idea who it was.
But each of those individuals, when the search was placed upon each of those individuals, each of their expectations of privacy was violated. Thirdly, it must be likely that the injury will be redressed in a favorable judicial decision. It is likely that the violation of Private Flores' Fourth Amendment rights will be redressed by a favorable judicial decision because he has standing to challenge such violation. Now, there is an exception to this general rule of standing where an individual may lack standing. The broader exception prevents individuals from challenging the legality of their search and seizure of their personal property and subsequently having the fruits of that search admitted against them into evidence when the individual has abandoned his property. And this rationale goes back to the concept of the individual no longer having a reasonable expectation of privacy. When the property has been abandoned, there is no longer ownership of it. And that person can no longer assert that they have an expectation of privacy because they have relinquished all of their interest in the property. The more narrow view of this exception, however, which is the view that is actually relevant in this case, purports that where the individual discards his personal property in direct response to an illegal search, such discarding of property does not prevent the individual from challenging his Fourth Amendment rights. And this exception complies with the factors of whether or not the individual has truly abandoned his property. Your Honors, the critical inquiry in this case is the intent. What is the subjective intent of Private Flores? Was the subjective intent reasonable, or one that society is willing to accept as reasonable?
Counsel, is there any place in the record that shows us what the subjective intent of Private Flores was?
I contend that when the bags were discovered and searched, they found several items in there identifying Private Flores as its owner, an alpha coat with his name inscribed on it and mail with his name on it as well. I contend that this supports the inference that it was a last-minute decision on Private Flores' behalf to switch the bags, that he did not have the intent to do so prior to, or he would have taken those items out that would have easily identified him as the owner.
But there's nothing in the record that informs us as to what his actual intent was, other than inferences that you can make and the government can make. Is that correct?
That's correct. Now, the intent should be inferred from the words and actions of the individuals and other circumstances surrounding the alleged abandonment. Your Honors, Private Flores did not have the intent to abandon his property. He never denied ownership of the bag. In fact, when he was even questioned about the bag and first confronted about the bag, he admitted to owning the bag. Yes, he switched the bag, but only after he learned of the search. Nevertheless, the trial court erroneously found to the contrary.
Counsel, you said he never intended to abandon it?
No, he never intended to voluntarily abandon his bag.
Well, I thought counsel for the appellant was admitting that he abandoned it, but he abandoned it in such a way as to point to it being abandoned in response to an unlawful search.
Well, that's how...
Is that your position, or is it your position that he never abandoned it at all?
My position is that he did abandon his bag, which he switched the bag.
Mm-hmm.
But the law says that if it's an involuntary abandonment, that the individual is not, they still have the right to challenge their Fourth Amendment rights. And I think that's what he was arguing, that he abandoned it, but it was an involuntary abandonment.
Okay.
Your Honorable Court, you have the power to reverse a decision made by a lower court that is clearly erroneous or based on unsupported evidence in the record. This decision in this case was just that, based on unsupported evidence. Virtually nothing in the record corroborates when Private Flores actually switched the bags. The only evidence offered, which was the evidence that the court relied on, was a statement based on speculation by Private Sequeira, the same private in which Private Flores switched his bags with. Private Sequeira testified that he believed that the bags were switched on the parade deck before knowledge of the search. Your Honors, I contend that that is not a sufficient finding of fact. Had he said he knew that the bags were switched on the parade deck prior to having knowledge, then it may be a different story. But he didn't, because he didn't know. No one knows when the bags were switched except Private Flores. And Private Flores contends that he switched the bags after he learned of the search. In fact, the records support this at a greater view. When the bag was discovered and searched, several items were found in the bag identifying Private Flores as its owners. This supports the inference of a last-minute decision on Private Flores' behalf to switch his bags. If Private Flores intended to relinquish all of his rights in the bag and lose his expectation of privacy in the bag, we contend that he would have removed those self-identifying items. But the facts show that he couldn't, because after finding out about the search moments before it would occur, he did not have the time. He only had time to hurriedly and hastily get rid of the bag. Your Honors, it is clear that no one really knows when Private Flores switched the bags. One thing that we do know is that the search was unlawful and that Private Flores' rights were violated, which entitles Private Flores with the right to challenge the violation of his constitutional rights. Again, there is no sufficient evidence to determine when Private Flores switched his bags. And even if you do find the testimony was sufficient, Private Flores never denied ownership of his bag and thus lacked the intent.
Counsel, I'll ask you the same question I asked counsel for the defense, which at least some of us will be struggling with, and that is, what account, if any, can we take of the fact that the person with the best knowledge of the intent, Flores, didn't testify here? Can we? Could the judge have taken that into account, and can we take that into account?
I don't think that you can take it into account against him because of his Fifth Amendment rights. However, I do agree that he is the only one that knows what his true intent was, and because we did not get his testimony, the only thing that we can go is on inferences, which is what the lower court based their decision on.
Thank you. If you'd like to briefly conclude.
Okay. The lower court cited in its case United States versus Hoy, where the court held, when determining abandonment, we must look at both the physical act and the intent of the individual. In this case, Private Flores did not have the intent. Your Honor, Private Flores should be entitled to his Fourth Amendment protection. Please, Your Honorable Court, again, we pray that you reverse the decision of the trial court as required by our Fourth Amendment rights against illegal searches and seizures, because Private Flores did have standing to challenge the illegal government search because he deposited or switched his bags in direct response to the illegal search, and alternatively, Private Flores did not have the intent to abandon his bag because he never denied ownership of the bag when questioned. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation today. We will now hear for counsel for the government.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Major Brian Keller. I represent the government. Your Honors, two preliminary issues before the government dives into its argument. First of all, with regard to the law of the case doctrine, that does not apply here. In this case, the finding of voluntary abandonment obviated any need to find that there was an illegal or illegal search. As the Hodari case states, the seizure of voluntarily abandoned property does not give rise to any investigation as to whether there was a Fourth Amendment issue or not.
But both the military judge and the CCA addressed that issue.
Yes, Your Honor. The military judge did conclude that there was an illegal search. However, again, he found that the property was voluntarily abandoned. So under Hodari and other voluntary abandonment cases, there was no need for him to go on and make this superfluous finding that there was no probable cause.
Even if from a legal perspective there is technically no need for it, he did make the finding, and it is in the record, and it hasn't been appealed.
Yes, Your Honor. That is correct. With regards to the law of the case doctrine, where the court has a definite and firm conviction that a prior ruling under a material matter is unreasonable or obviously wrong, the court can overturn a lower judge's findings. A few notes about that. The lower court stated that the government conceded that it was an illegal search. That's not the case. That was not in the brief. Trial counsel did not concede that it was an illegal search, and I believe the lower court stated that the government had conceded at the lower during trial. However, trial counsel himself said this is a reasonable search under Drew and under the Harmon line of cases.
My recollection is that the government did not correct that point either through a motion with the CCA or in its initial response to the petition in this case.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. The government will get to the argument about probable cause and the fact that the government believes that it's a reasonable search as the argument continues. Secondly, the question is not whether appellant knew of an impending search. The question under Hodari is whether when the bag was switched, is how Hodari puts it, appellant was already seized. So when appellant switched the bag, was he already seized? If he had testified, indeed, there would be evidence on the record that perhaps could lend itself towards that finding. However, there's not, and as the government will detail in its argument, there is evidence that supports that the military judge's conclusion that it was a voluntary abandonment is not a fanciful finding, in fact.
In terms of the fact that the defendant didn't testify at trial, what, if any, use can we make of that on appeal?
Your Honor, had appellant testified, there would be evidence on the record that perhaps could lend to his argument, which is that he believed that he was seized at the time, and therefore he had no choice but to abandon his bag. If that was the case, then that would fall into the exception carved out by Hodari, where he was seized and he threw it out in direct response to law enforcement action. However, that's not the case here. We don't have that evidence on the record. He didn't testify. All we have, as the government will argue, is at least four pieces of evidence that suggest that indeed he did voluntarily abandon his
bag. So is it the government's position that we cannot take into account as an inference against the defense the fact that he did not testify on this matter of intent?
No, Your Honor, that's not what the government meant to say.
That's my question. My question is, the defendant didn't testify. He's the person with the best knowledge of his intent as to when the abandonment took place and what its relationship was to the search. The military judge, according to the defense, made no mention of that at trial. Therefore, the defense argues we can't make use of it on appeal. What's the government's position as to whether we, on appeal, can take into account the fact that the defense didn't testify at trial?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, you may take that into account. He did not testify, so there is no evidence on the record that would have helped him from his own mouth. However, there is evidence against him on the record that suggested it was a voluntary abandonment. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
I have your answer. Thanks. Yeah.
Sure.
Counsel, before you get into your argument, on conclusion of law number 3, the military judge found that Flores voluntarily abandoned his clothing bag before the battalion commander made the decision to order the search.
Yes, sir.
Where in the record is that supported?
The record suggests that at 09, the commander cover.
I'm looking for record sites here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Are we looking at page 72 and 73? Is that where you're?
I'm checking the pages, Your Honor. There's a page, and the government doesn't have it in front of it right now, but it says that at 09, Lieutenant Colonel Cover ordered the search, and that's the time when the recruits were already out on the parade deck.
And what the military judge found was that the switch occurred before that time, so it occurred before 09.
Yes,
what I'm trying to find out is where in the record is there any support for the fact that the switch was made prior to 09?
The government doesn't have the page site right in front of it, but the recruits had already taken the bags and staged them out on the parade deck before 09. That combined with the fact that Lieutenant Colonel Cover said that he ordered the guards on at 09 and other testimony that suggested that they were there to make sure that nobody touched the bags lends itself to a reasonable, certainly not a fanciful inference, that when appellant fell in on the bag, he fell in on the bag as he had already switched it. So it's not fanciful to conclude that he had switched it before the guards were posted on the bags, Your Honor.
But I guess my question is there any hard evidence in the record that shows that Flores switched the bag before 09?
It's circumstantial, Your Honor. Circumstantial at best. I should take the at best part back because there's nothing wrong with circumstantial.
No, there is nothing wrong with circumstantial. What do we make of the fact that that this was a difficult issue at the trial? I mean, the trial counsel argued the appellant's argument. The trial counsel on this motion argued that Flores made the switch after he learned of the investigation. He was at the hearing. He was the guy who was there representing the government's interest. Can we read anything into that?
Your Honor, it's simply that it's a fact that he switched the bags after he learned of the investigation.
I misstated that he switched the bags after he learned of the impending search.
That was not the military judge's conclusion of fact, though, Your Honor. And the facts don't support that.
Well, that exactly. Well, okay.
So, to follow up on where my perception of that last dialogue is that the trial counsel, according to that dialogue, argued that the switch took place after learning of the impending search trial.
I would argue, sir, that PFC Flores intentionally switched those bags to try to avoid detection. If in fact...
Well, yes, Your Honor, but that's because it was in response. Forgive me for interrupting. That's because it was in response to knowing of the investigation.
He knew he was going to be searched, was his next sentence.
Yes, Your Honor, but that was not the military judge's conclusion. And certainly the facts on the record support that it was after the investigation and before the search. And I think that was a misstatement on the trial counsel's part.
So that was the erroneous argument on the
part. Well, yes, Your Honor. And that's not the facts, obviously. That's just trial counsel's argument. But clearly, at least three pieces of evidence on the record support the military judge's findings that before appellant was seized. And again, the critical question under Hodari is whether at the time that the bag was switched, was appellant seized or not, that in the law of voluntary abandonment. And three pieces of evidence clearly support the military judge's finding there. First of all, that appellant carried, and this has already been briefly gone over by appellant, but appellant carried Private Sakhar's bags back from the parade deck with him to the barracks. He ignored any suggestion to take his own bags back with him, so therefore any show of force he was ignoring, he was rebuffing any show of force that he had to take his bag back to the barracks. He unpacked them himself, he emptied them, and then he repacked them. He made absolutely, and that's page 42 of the record, despite unpacking items which were clearly not his, he said nothing and passed them off as his own. As Your Honors have already pointed out, that clearly evidences voluntary abandonment. instead of remaining to try to find his own bag, appellant left the squad bay with somebody else's bag, again supporting a voluntary abandonment finding. Second of all of the two members had been investigated the night before and interrogated until late in the morning. Appellant clearly, therefore, knew an investigation was going on, and this lends itself also to a finding of voluntary abandonment, that because he knew there was an investigation like police surveillance in Kozak, the Army Corps of Military Review case, and the Hodari case, in response to that, he decided he was going to abandon his bag. Third of all, Sergeant Miramontes, the drill instructor, testified that Private Sakhar was surprised at the contents of his bag. He denied ownership fairly quickly, unlike appellant, when Private Sakhar's bag was opened, and he exclaimed that his gear was next to appellant's on the parade deck, and, quote, note the volitional language that he used, it's not accidental language, quote, when he bent down to grab his sea bag, he believed his body bag was switched on him. So again, a volitional, intentional switching, and that lends itself as the third piece of evidence to voluntary abandonment. There's no clear abuse of discretion, using the standard then, in finding that there was voluntary abandonment of the property.
Going back to the trial level, and one of the questions I'm struggling with here is this question of burdens. There's evidence that's introduced that the property was abandoned. What happens next in terms of which party is responsible for dealing with the issue of whether the abandonment took place in the context of an impending search? How do we sort out what a military judge is supposed to do at trial, and then we review on appeal in terms of which party has the burdens of going forward and then the burdens of persuasion?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, it's the evidence that's on the record. The government had presented evidence at trial that there was a voluntary abandonment. If appellant sought to rebut that, he could rebut that, but presented no evidence rebutting that. Therefore, on preponderance, or rather, the military judge's decision is reviewed for abuse of discretion. If it was fanciful, clearly erroneous, or arbitrary and capricious, it can be overturned. The government's contention is here, appellant clearly voluntarily gave up his bag.
Did the defense at trial, although not presenting evidence on it, argue based on the evidence presented? And how does that, where does that take us in terms of who's responsible for the burden of persuasion as opposed to the burden of production at that point?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, appellant did argue, however, that the argument, again, is not evidence. He gave a way for the military judge to interpret the evidence, and the military judge concluded that it was voluntary abandonment. It's certainly the government's contention, not a fanciful finding.
And who bore the burden of persuasion at that stage and why? What do we look for in terms of precedent or rule? That is, the government has introduced all the evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
The government has argued abandonment. The defense is arguing that the evidence doesn't demonstrate voluntary abandonment. Who bears the burden of persuasion, and what would we look to as the source of law on that?
the government does not have any case sites at its hands, but it's the government's burden to show that it was a demonstrate that it was a legal search, which it did, and then if it was voluntarily abandoned, the government demonstrated that, and the appellant would have to then show that there was again some nexus, or rather that he was at the time that the bag was he was seized at the time that he switched the bag.
So it's your view that the defense bears the if maybe putting words in your mouth, so please change if I'm
yes,
saying
sir.
It that once the government has demonstrated voluntary abandonment, it's the defense burden of persuasion to show that the abandonment was based on knowledge of an impending search.
Well, again, Your Honor, not knowledge of impending search, but they would have to show that the government's facts were wrong, that in fact he had been seized at the time that he switched the bags, and the according to Hodari, and the facts on the record don't indicate that, Your Honor. Again, there was no evidence presented, or rather, there was no evidence presented during motions that the platoon members knew why they were going back to the squad bay, or why they were being marched back to the squad bay, even if knowledge were a factor, and despite his contention.
So it's your position that Floria's knowledge as to whether or not there was going to be a search is irrelevant?
Well, had he testified, Your Honor, that could show whether he was seized or not at the time, obviously.
But I mean, for our purposes right now,
yes,
the way this is.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree with the statement that an individual who discards his property in reaction to illegal police conduct has not abandoned his privacy interest?
An individual who abandons it in...
An individual who discards property in reaction to an illegal police conduct has not abandoned his privacy interest in the property.
In some cases, Your Honor, if it's a direct response to the police conduct, then yes, Your Honor. But again, he would have to be somehow seized, according to the Hardari language.
But why?
Go ahead.
What does seizure have to do with the question of voluntary abandonment? If somebody is told with no ambiguity that within X amount of time, imminent, your property is going to be searched.
Well, there was no illegal police action there, Your Honor. That's just a statement.
No, I understand that. And the person abandons the property at that point, and it turns out that the evidence would have been seized illegally. And the individual testifies they abandoned it because I was told it was going to be searched. I had to get rid of it at that point. That's not
that's
in your view a voluntary abandonment, not an involuntary abandonment?
It could be, Your Honor. It depends on all the circumstances. In this case, it's not fanciful to conclude that appellant did not know that he was going to be searched at the time he went back to the barracks. Certainly, there's nothing during motions.
Not asking about this case. I'm asking about the question of law as to whether Hodari establishes the full landscape of the law, and that someone actually has, you have to have an actual seizure at this point, as opposed to having firm and definitive knowledge that the seizure is going to take place.
Yes, Your Honor, and it depends on who's telling him that, too. We don't know who told the appellant that his bag was going to get seized, even if he knew that when he went back to the barracks. All we know is, as in the Sanford case, this was mere compliance with military orders. We have appellant information told by somebody who was not conducting the search.
Military orders for a law enforcement purpose.
There may be an attenuation here, Your Honor. We have no idea. The person that told him to march back is not the same person who conducted the search, the Sergeant Miramontes. So information, they were marched back to the squad bay.
For what? They were marched back to the squad bay with the bags for what reason?
Yes, Your Honor, to accomplish at some point the search. But once they got back to the squad bay, they were staying in formation, and the search did not actually occur. He was not given the direct order, you are now going to be searched, open your sea bag, where his privacy interest was actually implicated. Until he got back in the squad bay, staying in formation after complying with those military orders.
The fact that he's under military control, standing in a formation with everybody getting searched, is not indication that he is going to be searched and he's free to walk away?
Well, again, Your Honor, that's not the question. Obviously, he ignored the order that he was to take his bag back to the squad bay. He switched it when he was on the squad bay, or whether when he was on the parade deck. That was the military judge's conclusion. It's certainly not fanciful to conclude that he switched it prior to the search. And again, the search, the government's contention, happens when he gets back to the squad bay and they're called out one by one, and then he is then asked, open your bag, reveal all the contents. At that point, he had already switched his bag.
Can we move on to inevitable discovery here before you run out of time?
Yes, Your Honor.
And could you tell me what is the standard here in your brief, I believe you argued that with the addition of this new information, that the government would have been able to confront him and he would have confessed and you would have gotten the same result.
That was the military judge's conclusion, yes, Your Honor.
Is that the government's position?
The government stands on its brief with regard to the confession, Your Honor.
How do we know that he would have confessed? And if he wouldn't have confessed, where are we? I mean, aren't we doing a little speculation there? Do you have to show that there is probable cause there, or what's your standard?
Your Honor, the standard is preponderance of the evidence. Whether there is enough evidence to show that by a preponderance of the evidence, appellant would have, with regard to the confession, made the same confession that he did. And certainly the government argues in its brief that that appellant would have been put into the same position as he was had the search not occurred at that time.
So you have to establish that the additional evidence would have compelled the same confession that Flores gave after he was confronted with the cash?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's a pretty high burden.
Routine, well, preponderance of the evidence, Your Honor, that routine law enforcement measures or routine measures would have produced, would have put appellant into the same position. So arguably, Lieutenant Colonel Cover could have waited until CID had put all the pieces together, which were already there in the interrogations from the night before, that appellant was the platoon scribe, that he was the one that had asked for the pins. Gunnery Sergeant Alexander, I believe, testified at trial that despite appellant saying that the senior drill instructor had passed the order on to him to get all the pins for the ATM numbers, Gunnery Sergeant Alexander at trial testified that he never, in fact, gave any orders to appellant to ask pin numbers or to ask anything from the platoon. So all that put together that had developed, certainly that appellant could have been honed in on and a different kind of search warrant could have been sought.
Well, so the standard is not would this additional evidence have focused attention on appellant, but that it would have elicited the same confession. Is that your position?
Well, it's.
I mean, I'm not asking.
Yes,
I'm not asking that as a question of fact. I'm saying, is that the standard?
Well, it's whether routine processes of law enforcement agency would otherwise find the same evidence.
Find the same evidence and elicit the same confession aren't the same thing.
Certainly the same evidence would have been produced.
Yeah.
As Your Honors already went through, the money in the vents up above, appellant would have been focused on. So certainly inevitable discovery with regard to all that evidence, no problem. Appellant would have been found out. He would have been focused on. But then the question is, as the military judge found, would the same confession have been produced? And
we review that as an abuse of discretion.
The same way, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Because the inevitable discovery is not the inevitable discovery of the evidence in the ceiling. It's the inevitable discovery of the confession.
That's what the military judge found, yes, Your Honor.
But isn't that what's at issue in this case? That
yes,
is,
sir.
If we had, and you're not conceding, an illegal search at the beginning, then the question is, without the illegal search, would you get a confession? My question is, what impact is there in terms of the circumstances of the initial confession and the passage of time? Here we had an individual who, assuming he had engaged in this activity, believes he may have gotten away with it, about to graduate off the island, and just about as he's going to get out, all of a sudden everything falls apart very quickly in the morning. He's confronted and he confesses. Now, correct me if I'm on the wrong track here, but I think the way we have to look at this is if that never happened.
Yes.
That is, as if that never happened, and 2 weeks later, the material is found in the ceiling. He's now gone and far away from the place, and officer of the agent of the Naval Investigation Service or someone else comes to him and confronts him with this information. Why should we view the confession as inevitable in that situation? Different circumstances of the confrontation, different passage of time.
Yes, Your Honor.
He may well have confessed, but why is it an inevitable?
Well, if the government can step back a little bit in time, ratchet back in time, One would not have to wait until the items were found in the ceiling 2 weeks later to apply the inevitable discovery to the confession. Certainly, Lieutenant Colonel Cover, under normal processes, routine processes of law enforcement, could have held the bags there. And this gets this also begs the question, or brings us back to the question of whether the seizure of the bag, or the holding of the bags there by the guards, and appellants marching back to the squad bay itself was illegal. Certainly, those bags could have been held there much, much longer. They could have been back, walked back to the squad bay and stood there for a long time and just waited while the investigation was being completed. And under
held,
those,
held as evidence.
Well, they could have been held there and just waited until the investigation was completed. Certainly, that's a temporary stop while the investigation is being completed. As the investigation was looked at and the evidence that had been developed on the 3rd was looked at, certainly by sometime on the 4th or the 5th, maybe the 6th, at cost to the government, and this will come into play in the reasonable, in the reasonableness of the search argument, as that investigation was being developed, maybe 3 days later, they could have focused on appellant, and they could have gotten a different kind of probable cause to search his bag. So it's not a question, the government contends, on waiting 2 weeks while appellant is gone. Lieutenant Colonel Cover could, as commander, with his powers as commander, held them there while the investigation was being completed. Again, at cost to the government, their families were there waiting to fly out, et cetera.
Okay, back to the law of the case. You started off on this, and then you kind of diverted. Are we bound by the finding that the search was unlawful? And if so, why?
Yes, Your Honor. With a caveat, number one, the government's contention is that the law of the case doctrine is not implicated here because the finding of voluntary abandonment...
Yeah, but leave that aside.
Yes, Your Honor.
You know, because we don't have to get into abandonment if the search wasn't inherently unlawful.
Yes, Your Honor.
So are we bound by the finding that the search was unlawful?
No, Your Honor, because of the voluntary abandonment finding. But second, yes, Your Honor. But second, no, you're not because of the law of case doctrine.
And what does the law of the case doctrine say here?
If this court believes that has a definite and firm conviction that a prior ruling on a material matter is unreasonable or obviously wrong, the court can overturn a lower judge's finding, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Why didn't the government then appeal that if it's so obviously that it's wrong?
Well, if the government had appealed it, then the law of case doctrine wouldn't be implicated, Your Honor. So,
well,
forgive me for jumping around on these answers, but we don't agree that the law of the case doctrine is implicated here, but assuming that it is.
But you didn't appeal it.
Yes, Your Honor.
And now you're arguing that we are supposed to take a look at it and say that this is such a crucial ruling and it's so wrong that we should review it, even though the law of the case doctrine says normally we would not renew it. My question is that if it is that obvious and if it is that wrong, why didn't the government appeal it?
The government has no good answer for that, Your Honor. However, it is a probable cause search. There is case law from this court, from the Court of Military Appeals, rather, that suggests that this was a good probable cause search within the military context.
Any of those cases that predate, postdate the adoption of Rule 313, and for those that did, what's the implication of Rule 313, which is the rule that is the demarcation between inspections and lawful searches?
Well, Your Honor, yes, some of those predated and some of those postdated. This court the Court of Military Appeals, rather, in 87, held the door open in the Moore case that in some cases you could have a broader probable cause search. This gets back to...
is that a holding?
No, Your Honor, that was dicta. But again, so was the holding in, so was the majority opinion, the chief judge's opinion, I believe, in Roberts, where he said that shakedown searches are never lawful. That was unsupported. That was only one of three judges that made that statement.
Why do we have to look at any of those cases without first looking at the underlying rule, Rule 313?
Yes, Your Honor.
And as I read the government's brief before the Court of Criminal Appeals, as I read the government's brief here, there is no argument on the issue of whether this is or is not a permissible search under 313 with the definitive requirements that are set forth there for this type of inquiry.
Yes.
And the burdens that the government has to meet.
That's correct, Your Honor, because this case has nothing to do with Rule 313. Judge Cox, in the concurring opinion in the Lopez case, recognized at length four different applications of the Fourth Amendment with regard to the military setting. First of all, there's no writing requirement for warrants. Second of all, there's no affirmation or sworn affirmation requirement. Third of all, judicial officers are not required. Only military commanders are required to make search authorizations. That's different than the regular Fourth Amendment application. Fourth, inspections. So there's the 313 inspections, and that is an exception, which, and again, I believe Lopez was after the adoption of the 313, because he's talking about the exceptions situation. The source of the CO's power also recognized in the Lopez case, and I believe in the Stuckey case and Middleton case, several other cases. Again, some of these are about inspections, but that's not this case. Recognized that the CO's search power does not derive from the Fourth Amendment. It derives instead from the Congress and the President and longstanding military custom, even though the Fourth Amendment has been applied in several situations normally to service members. There's a different application of the Fourth Amendment.
Let's not even talk about the Fourth Amendment. Talk about the rules of evidence for a courts-martial.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which of those rules here is an exception to the requirement for probable cause focusing on an individual?
Well, if this court were to agree that there was no probable cause, then I believe it's 314K, which says that searches otherwise allowed under the Constitution would be permissible.
So it's the government's view that 314K is an additional exception to Rule 313, so that the commander gets two bites of the apple. If the commander violates 313, no problem, because you just go to 313A and say whatever the commander does, if they can articulate some sort of military interest, that's a good search. If that were the case, what's the point of any of these rules?
Well, Your Honor, 314K says search is otherwise permissible under the Constitution. So if Congress didn't intend that, they didn't have to write it, but certainly it's in the rules and it applies.
I'm not aware of a single word, please correct me if I'm wrong, that Congress has written on
You're
this
right.
subject whatsoever.
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't it the President of the United States under a delegation from
the
Congress?
The government misspoke, Your Honor, but certainly that's an exception that is listed in there. Moreover, applying the Fourth Amendment, as Judge Cox correctly points out in the Lopez case and several of these other cases point out, there is a different application of the Fourth Amendment. The government is not contending there's not a reasonable expectation of privacy. The government's not contending the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply. However, it's long been recognized that the Fourth Amendment does apply differently. The military context, moreover, and the government suggests that there is a fifth exception. The military context elicits that fifth exception when taking a look at the military context. There are unit deployments, there are unit movements, there are training classes, there are operational movements, and these are all unique aspects of military life as recognized by the court multiple times and several times recently. The fact that deployments are a unique circumstance of military life has been recognized in the last
Was there a probable cause to believe that the contraband, any contraband, was in the bags?
Yes, Your Honor, because there was perhaps with a less particularization, but again, the lesser particularization is that different military context that requires perhaps a fifth exception to how the Fourth Amendment is applied to the military context, Your Honor. Not the probable cause is not applied, perhaps a different particularization.
Counsel, you keep talking about the Fourth Amendment. I'm talking about the rules of evidence. Rule 311. Evidence is searched from unlawful searches and seizures. 312, body views and intrusions. 313, inspections. 314, searches not requiring probable cause. If 314K means what you say it says, that is, if you got deployment, you got training, then none of these rules need to be taken to Iraq or Afghanistan, do they? Commanders can do whatever they want over there, say, we're in a war zone, and we don't have to have probable cause to search individuals when we have suspicion that they may be involved in criminal activity. That the President wrote all those rules just for those posts back in the United States, and that overseas, they don't apply.
May the government finish and wrap up with
yes,
a
and,
short
and,
conclusion?
I'd like to add at this point that we did give the defense a bit more time, and there was an amicus on behalf of the defense. So if the government needs another minute or two or whatever you need within reason here,
yes,
we don't want to cut your argument short. So please take the time you need to conclude.
The government understands what you're asking, Your Honor. The Fourth Amendment is critical to the discussion, however, because, again, 314K says otherwise permitted by the Constitution. So, looking at Parker v. Levy, looking at the cases that talk about how the Constitution applies to service members within the Supreme Court and within the Court of Military Appeals and CAF context, there is a different application. So it's needed to look at how the Fourth Amendment applies to the service members and then look at a different circumstance here where you have unit deployments, you have large groups of people moving from one place or another. In this very discrete circumstance, it would behoove, the government believes that it would behoove this court to take a look again at the Harmon and Drew line of cases, and where it would be at great cost to the government in readiness, where groups of classes cannot move on to the next station, they cannot move on to their next duties, they cannot perhaps deploy because a quick search needs to happen with perhaps less than the regular particularization of probable cause. Perhaps that is another circumstance which might be allowed in the military context, Your Honor. In conclusion, the military judge acted well within his discretion in receiving and interpreting the evidence to mean that the appellant had voluntarily abandoned his bag prior to search. Moreover, the overwhelming evidence pointing to appellant, had he not confessed so quickly, would have been by the same preponderance of evidence pointing to appellant and put him in the exact same position he was in when he actually did confess, as argued in the government's brief. The military judge erred then, and this court's case law in any case suggests a need for revisiting the application of the Fourth Amendment to searches made reasonable by the military context of unit movements, graduations, dismantings of units, and affirming the viability of such searches for commanders in the field and in garrison. The government therefore respectfully requests that the lower court's judgment be affirmed. Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you, counsel. Did you have another question? Does the defense have any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Before you start, I'd like to turn back to right where you started before. You asserted that this court lacks jurisdiction, and that you asserted that in your brief to consider the underlying legality of the search. And I went back and looked at your reply brief, and it looks to me like you're making an argument of waiver, not jurisdiction. But if I've missed something, please let me know.
I apologize, Your Honor. I believe... Yes, Your Honor. I apologize. Appellant has misspoke.
Thank you. It is
waiver instead of jurisdiction. However, in answer to Judge Erdman's question, if I may read from the relevant record of trial, on page 57, we see that that Sergeant Miramontes is questioned. And you discovered that they were given to the drill instructors, the envelopes he's talking about, were given to the drill instructors by the scribe, correct? Answer, that's what was briefed to me by the platoon. Skipping over. And when did you find this information out? Answer, during the screening interviews on the night of that Thursday night. The investigators are aware of the fact of the modus operandi on Thursday night. So therefore, the government cannot invoke the inevitable discovery doctrine because, again, no new leads would have focused the suspicion on appellant to the point where he would have confessed.
But none of that evidence you just talked about would be excluded because of the confession.
No, Your Honor, but...
I mean, the confession came later, and obviously if the confession was a result of an illegal search, nothing can be used as a result of that.
Yes, Your Honor, but the indication was, I believe the original question was there any evidence in the record to show that the modus operandi was known before the order was given,
and it was.
It was, Your Honor. Again, appellant admits the fact that the appellant has the burden of proof when establishing such a motion to suppress. But however, when this court reviews the military judge's finding of fact and law, it is still upon review that the military judge's findings of fact must be supported by the record. Again, it is, as this court has noted, it is circumstantial evidence, but again, just because the sidewalk is wet in the morning, it probably rained last night. This court has actually indicated questions about whether appellant abandoned his argument, his luggage, or whether appellant accidentally discarded his luggage. And appellant simply took the facts most in light to the government. And even when you take the facts most in light to the government can't meet their burden. Appellant respectfully suggests to this court that it is actually a distinction without a difference. If appellant accidentally abandons his bag, he maintains his privacy interest in the bag. If appellant abandons his bag in direct results to an illegal search, he maintains his privacy interest within the bag. Therefore, the very fact that appellant abandons or accidentally abandons his luggage seems to be not the actual issue. The actual issue is...
Why wouldn't that seem to be a critical issue in this case when we're talking about if the accidental abandonment is not a forfeiture of your privacy interest, whereas the abandonment in light of a knowledge of an investigation may turn on whether that knowledge is then supplemented by knowledge of a search?
Yes, Your Honor. An appellant actually argues both. However, if an appellant was just merely taking the facts most in light to the government, if we read the facts most in light to the government, we see that appellant abandoned his property interest in direct response to the illegal search. However, this court can freely hold that the record supports an accidental abandonment. Again, the real question is actually just a matter of time. We have, if this court chooses to invoke the law of the case doctrine instead of waiver, we see that the commanding officer had no probable cause, no individualized suspicion, and in fact the government, I believe, conceded when it was talking about inevitable discovery that they simply could have froze the crime scene in order to develop new leads. The commanding officer instead chose to violate appellant's Fourth Amendment rights. If there are no further questions, appellant would respectfully like to conclude by saying that we are honored here to be a guest of Southern University Law Center, that this university has, that this law center has produced such legal scholars such as Jesse Stone Jr., Alvin Basil Jones, Leroy White, Allison Frederick Dyson, and Alex Lewis Pritcher. It's quite ironic that we are arguing this case in such a distinguished school that has produced these legal scholars, because these legal scholars were known for advocating individual rights. Appellant had a privacy interest in his luggage when he was ordered by his commanding officer to be marched into a squad bay without a warrant, forced open to rip his own luggage apart in a generalized search for incriminating evidence. Because the military judge made an erroneous finding of fact, and because the inevitable discovery doctrine does not apply, appellant respectfully requests relief from this court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank counsel for both parties for your argument today. And we thank counsel for the amicus for your fine presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the clerk will adjourn the court. After we adjourn, the judges will remain in place for a question and answer session. I'll have more about that in a minute.
The court stands adjourned until further order of the court. Please be seated.
Thank you. At one time, when we did these project outreach questions and answers, we would leave, take off our robes, and come back to create a little bit more informal atmosphere, but everybody would get the impression, well, it's time to leave now. So we decided in recent years we would stay on the bench. And we are honored to be here today at Southern University, and very appreciative of all the hospitality that's been extended to us. Typically, at the end of the outreach, we have an opportunity for questions and answers from the audience. You have before us our biographies, and so you have some information about us. Feel free to ask any questions about us, our backgrounds, what it's like to be a judge, anything about except about today's case and pending cases as well. And with the indulgence of counsel, I will make them available for your questions too, because I know many of you will be interested in the experience in military service of lawyers and what they do. So without further ado, let me open the panel for a short time of questions. You have some questions from the audience. Well, I'll start out then with a question just to get it going for Judge Stuckey, who is one of our new appointees. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's like to make the transition from working in the legislative branch of government to the judicial office that you hold now?
It's quite different, and I will preface it with the caveat that I am only now getting my chambers set up. So as Judge Efron said when he first got there, it's like drinking from a hose. We are given a generous authorization for chambers personnel, but getting the authorization, getting the warm bodies in there, and getting them working together are two different things. I've hired most of my chambers personnel and only had one of them start. So far I'm relying on the central legal staff, which has favored Judge Ryan and me with bench memoranda and other things like that. So at the moment I'm still going down to the third time. More generally, to answer the Chief Judge's question, because he shares my experience, we both were in the legislative branch of government. We both, in fact, worked for the Senate Committee on Armed Services before we came to the court. The court's workload is far more regular. Working on Capitol Hill is a feast or famine proposition, and you are governed, your life is completely governed by the congressional schedule. When they're gone, you can be gone. When they're there, you have to be there. When they're there and doing something that involves your committee or your senator, you absolutely have to be there, ready with anything he needs, out there on the floor. If they're on the floor, I was on the floor all the time. But when they're not there, when they're in recess, lots of times you can kind of kick back and not wear a tie to work and you know, come in late and leave early and that kind of thing. The court's workload is a good deal more regular. Another thing I didn't know, I didn't realize coming to the court, because I had previous experience one level down on a service court of criminal appeals, and I thought, well, I know how to write opinions because I've done it on a service court of criminal appeals. Well, yeah, I know how to write opinions, but I didn't realize how much else there was to being on this court. You know, if you were on a service court of criminal appeals, basically all you did was write opinions and circulate them. The amount of petition practice, writ practice, motion practice, and all that other stuff that we get on the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is very substantial. And I was not prepared for the amount of time that those parts of the job would take. And they do take a substantial, particularly when you're first getting into the substance of it and you're still putting your staff together. It takes a very substantial amount of time away from things like writing opinions. So that's a brief preface. It's immensely rewarding. Judge Effer and I share the distinction of having had two of the best jobs in Washington, and I think we're both very happy to be here.
Since I asked Judge Stuckey a question before I turn to the audience, I need to balance that out with a question for Judge Erdman and a similar one, and that is, coming from your experience on a state Supreme Court, what would you say are some of the highlights in terms of similarities but also differences from the work that you had being a justice on a state Supreme Court?
Well, there was quite a bit of difference. In our state, I was in Montana on the Supreme Court. We were an appeal of right state, so any decision from a district court could be appealed, and so the workload was, you know, quadruple the workload that we have on this court. And being an appeal of right state, there was no petition process, so the court had to take every case that came up. In this court, as has earlier been mentioned, one of our primary jobs is deciding which cases we should be taking, because that really helps guide the court in which direction it's going to go in every term. And so that review of the cases is very important, and quite frankly, you rarely see that on a state Supreme Court. You never see it on a state Supreme Court that has direct appeal. Obviously, the other big difference is that this court has only criminal jurisdiction. And in a state Supreme Court, you have both, you have civil jurisdiction. On our court, it was about a third, a third, a third. There was a third that were family cases, divorce cases, custody cases, probate cases, a third that was criminal, and the other third was your normal civil work, contracts cases, torts cases, and those types of cases. Actually, the variety was very nice. But I was worried when I came to this court that, well, this is all just going to be criminal cases, and it might get kind of boring. In fact, people can come up with so many inventive ways of violating the law that rarely are these cases the same, and rarely are they boring. And it continues to be a very interesting job.
Some questions from our audience today.
Being selected to serve on this court, and do you have to have military experience to serve on this court?
Well, since Judge Stuckey just went through that, why don't you talk a little bit about, briefly about the selection process from the administration and congressional
panel? There are five judges on the court. They are formally appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. In other words, they require confirmation by the U.S. Senate. There is no statutory requirement that they have any prior military experience. All of the present judges have, in fact, served in one or another of the armed forces, but that's pure coincidence. There is no requirement that you have any background in military justice or that you have served in any of the armed forces. The process of selection, while it may vary in details from administration to administration, is roughly the same. In the case of this court, because we are attached to the Department of Defense for administrative purposes only, and because we come under the jurisdiction, the legislative jurisdiction, of the Armed Services Committees rather than the Judiciary Committees, as the Article III courts do, the Department of Defense General Counsel plays a part in the initial vetting of names for submission to the President, for submission to the White House, and in fact, the DOD General Counsel, approximately 18 months before the appointments were made, put out, knowing that there would be two vacancies on the court in October of 06, put out a letter to bar associations, practitioners in the field and the like, the Judge Advocates General and so forth, asking for the submission of names to be considered for the vacancies that would arise. Names were submitted. The department engaged in some sort of internal process, which I don't know the details of, but at some point last spring, the department had a list of approximately 20 names, which they then proceeded to interview. Interviews were held by the DOD General Counsel's people. And a list of some number of names, fewer than 20, how big I don't know, was submitted to the White House probably in late spring or early summer of last year. The White House counsel then took over the procedure, and some number of people were interviewed and vetted by White House counsel. I personally was interviewed by White House counsel in July of last year. Approximately a month and a half later, I was notified that I was the president, that subject to the clearance process, I was the president's selection for one of the two positions, and that I would immediately get in the mail a huge number of forms, which I had to fill out and turn around over a weekend. That happened, I turned them around, and then you engage in a little bit of back and forth with the FBI, which has to conduct a background investigation and so forth. But largely, what then ensued was about 2 months of silence. And because the Senate had adjourned for the elections at the end of September and was only coming back for a brief lame duck session, the question became, one, would the nominations go over, two, when? In fact, the Senate came back for a one-week lame duck session immediately post-election. We were notified, Judge Ryan and I were notified basically that week that the nominations would, subject to final approval by the President, be sent over that week. That is what happened. That enabled the Armed Services Committee to do its, to get its machinery in order, to put out the questions for the hearing, to plan for the hearing, and so forth. The Senate then came back in December for a one-week post-Thanksgiving lame duck session. The chairman had the hearing the first day they were back. The next day, the chairman took advantage of the Gates nomination hearing, which all the senators were at, that's a quorum, Mr. President, to vote the nominations out, and we were in fact confirmed the last night they were in session, and that was it. And then it took the White House about 10 days to prepare the commissions, which is the formal appointment, and then we took the oaths of office.
It's a lengthy process.
It's a very lengthy process.
A couple of historical notes. First, our statute requires that every judge be appointed from civil life.
Mm-hmm.
We're a civilian court, independent of the Department of Defense, we only get some administrative support for them. Secondly, Congress has defined from civil life to exclude anyone who has served on active duty in the military for 20 years. So even if you've retired, if you served on active duty for 20 years, just can't serve on our court. And finally, in terms of the process, the president has from time to time appointed judges who did not have any interview at the Department of Defense, but were picked by the president for some other reasons, just like on the Article III courts. Every once in a while, the president will just use his prerogative as the president of the United States and pick whoever the president wants. Judge Urban, did you have something you wanted to add as well?
Just to follow up, that the requirement that the judges on this court come from civil life, of course, come from our Constitution, and that is civilian control of the military. That the highest court in the military system is a court of civilians that are bringing that perspective to it rather than bringing a perspective of someone who had spent their entire career in the military.
Next question.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Dexter Whitbear. How does one apply for a federal clerkship under the under the Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces?
Good. I'll take a crack at that. There are a couple of things to look for. One is that on our website, and I believe you all have our brochure, and our website is listed on the back of there. There is a link for clerkships. It's going to be updated this spring because we've just gone through the cycle. But I would say look in another couple of weeks, and you'll see opportunities for applying for clerkships at the court. Now, each judge has complete independence as to what they do, so you have to check for each judge because different judges have different openings and different procedures. I'll just give you an example from my chambers. I follow the Article III judge process. That's the voluntary process for many Article III judges, and that is my openings are advertised in the spring. The application period takes place in September with the other Article III judges, and I try to have the applications reviewed, interviews set up, and a decision made within that September period. But there are other opportunities because some of the judges use a different cycle as well, so you have to check each one. In addition, we have opportunities for summer internships, and some of those are posted on the web as well for people who are in their first or second year. My requirements are a writing sample, a resume, transcript, and two letters of reference. Other judges may have different procedures as well. Typically, we will have one or two openings per judge per year for a clerkship. We have a mix of some permanent career-type clerks on the court, although it's an at-will position. They're there for a longer term. And we have a mix of turnover clerks who serve for just one or two years. Either of you want to add?
Only to say that at least in my case, and I think in the case generally, the judges, we're not necessarily looking for military experience, technical knowledge of the code, or anything like that. We're looking for the same qualities that I think any Article III judge would be looking for in a law clerk. Intellect, writing ability, ability to summarize, spot the issues, pick them out, lay them out for the judge, you know, write bench memos, write, you know, suggested questions for oral argument, that kind of thing. Kind of qualities that any Article III or other judge would be looking for, regardless of the specialized nature of our jurisdiction.
I think we had a question over here. Was there another, or someone was just stretching? Okay, some more questions from the audience. Do you have any questions you want to ask the council here today? They've done a great job of answering lots of questions already, but I know their supervisors haven't had a chance to answer any questions as well.
If one of the JAG attorneys would give us an idea as to how did they get to this point where they were arguing for this court?
Great. Why don't we start with the government first, since the defense had the opportunity to start last time.
How did I get to the law school? I got detailed the case the first time probably before the state's
year ago, year and a half ago, and went through the court criminal appeals process. So I was given the sorcerer's defense brief, and who wrote the defense brief? So somebody else wrote the defense brief below. That showed up on DXO's box at appellate government. There was a detail to me to write the response to, and I had a certain amount of time to write the response to. It was 30 days after the first appellate brief. And so I wrote the response, filed with CCA. We didn't argue the one below, but they issued a decision without oral argument. Then after that was issued, Lieutenant Yim made an appeal up to the Court of Appeals Armed Forces, and same thing happened. He filed a brief. I saw a copy of it, and I wrote the response. And internally in the office, just you know how we do things, we'll write the first draft. So I'm not sure what this was, like 25 pages or something like that. And then we'll circulate it around the office, and we'll give it to a colleague, and then it'll go to the XO or the CO of the office, and they'll do a copy. So there's a lot of quality control within that. I teach a law school class here, and I'm studying my students in the same way.
Could you comment on how you became a JAG, what steps you took, and also comment on whether or not you do the same things in the JAG TV show and jump out of airplanes and drive boats and stuff?
Yes, sir, I know, sir.
Okay.
No, we don't do the same thing. I went to undergrad in Minnesota, small liberal arts school, and then I went to the University of Nebraska for my first year of law school. And decided I had a patriotic urge. So during my first year, I decided I wanted to join the Marine Corps. Actually, I enlisted first. And the recruiter said, yeah, we'll take you. Until the Navy said, well, wait a second, there's a JAG for us. So when they told me what it was, they directed me back to the Marines. I wanted to become a Marine. And so I joined my first year and transferred to the University of Minnesota. Graduated there. Did two summer funds. While you're in law school, it's kind of like a clerkship sort of thing. But between your years at law school, you do TAD, temporary active duty, or TDY, at I did my first one in Yuma, Arizona. I did that for 10 weeks, 12 weeks, and they have you do, you know, kind of any legal things where you can actually get more experience.
It's an ad steps.
Then 1999, I started TDS. If you're a Marine, you got to go through infantry training too. So we did 6 months of infantry training, and then we went to
NJS and did the 10-12 weeks of NJS
in Newport, Rhode Island. So infantry training is real fun if you want to break the law. So there's nothing legal involved. That's how it happened.
Hi, my name is Lieutenant Yim. My story is actually kind of interesting. I had military background. I was actually sent from law school to become a corporate lawyer. I worked for a dot-com industry. I went through law. I graduated in the spring of 2001. A lot of people probably don't remember. In the winter of 2001, the NASDAQ crashed. And I lost my job. Apparently, this happened a lot. I lost my job. And so I went to the recruiter. I said, you know, the law school career counselor. I said, okay, what's left? Because, you know, it was pretty late when the NASDAQ crashed. And he said, the JAG Corps. And my law professor, I went to a law professor I respected and said, look, this is what's happening, what should I do? And he was like, you need to go to JAG Corps. He was excited. I was like, what are you talking about, professor? He was like, I hated the job that you were going to go to. You are not ready for a general counsel job. It's for if you want to retire and have a family. You need to become a lawyer first. You need to actually understand the practice of law. I didn't understand what he meant because, like I said, I was just in law school. So I signed up and walked away, and I got exposed to all of them before I went to the JAG Corps. And it's been kind of an interesting ride. I mean, the new JAG Corps, actually all the JAG Corps are supposed to be, but you have to do the deal. They give you experience quick. I've 2.5 years I was a criminal defense lawyer, and I have 5 cases, all the way up to attempted murder, all the way down to drug possession. And now I do this. I now appeal at the defense. I wrote briefs on behalf of the in front of 3 appellate courts, the service court, which is, you heard about times with the military court, and we have this court, which is the highest military court in the land. And I've been lucky enough to get certain certifications looking to the United States Supreme Court. So if you're looking to get some really fast experience, I'm talking like doctoral, like to actually know what it's like to be a lawyer. I would recommend
try to give your own books a shot.
But I said, I have no military background at all. And
that
I'm like, no,
I'll put
that
aside.
Thank you.
Your Honor, if I may.
Sure.
And I want to commander Paul Blanc, basically on behalf of the government, I'm the number two attorney there. I work for a Marine Colonel. I'm not gonna bore you with my background. One thing I wanna add that the wealth of education that the military spends to train you is amazing. I have two masters of arts degrees that the Navy has paid for. I have a fellow one that the Navy has paid for, and I'm in a PhD program that the Navy has trained for. So once you are in, and it is a competitive process to get in, and you are shrinking the military, it's not that easy to get in anymore. But once you're in, the opportunities for education, wherever it is, not just that graduate. Great lifestyle, and encourage everybody at least think about it.
Other questions? If not, what I'd like to, did I see another question hand coming up there? Okay. If not, I'd like to call Chancellor Pilcher forward. We have a presentation that our clerk is going to make at this point. We're just honored to be here. We're impressed by the school. We're impressed by the courtroom. And it's been a real privilege for us to have this opportunity. And what we're presenting is a lithograph of our court, our historic courthouse, that's being presented, signed by all the judges in deep appreciation for the honor of being here today at Southern University Law Center.
Presence. I think the students have really benefited tremendously from your being here. We try to, and I think we do a good job of educating our law students here, and this is another piece in that ever winding road to get to legal, to the legal heights that students are trying to achieve. And by having you here, that really helps them to understand what the real world about the law practice is all about. So we appreciate your being here, and thank you for coming. We'd like to invite you to join us for a reception down the hall with everybody who's here, down in our staff lounge. So thank you, judges. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you, and we'll look forward to seeing everyone who can stay and counsel and amicus, especially at the reception, a chance to have further dialogue and questions, and again to express our appreciation to you, Chancellor, for hosting us and at your historic school and for this experience. Thank you.
We have some special guests with us. I just want to let the Chief Judge know. The man from Dollar Tree City Chapter, the Honorable Chief City Chapter is here with the staff. They'll stand, please. We also have some guests from Fort Polk. Would you please stand, the guests from Fort Polk?
All right. Oh.
And last but not least, I'm very proud of my students who worked on the amicus. Would you please stand? Because I'm from Alabama, Mobile, I know that the most important people in the room are here now. The family, please stand for this post.
Thanks, Professor North, for your assistance in making this happen today. So we'll now adjourn to the reception. Thank you.
Thank you.